Welcome to Night Sky Tourist, a place to learn the night sky, have fun with its ancient stories, meet astronomers and dark sky advocates, and fall in love with the dark. I'm Vicki Dirksen, your host and author of the website and blog, nightskytourist.com. If you've never visited the website, I invite you to stop by after the podcast. Check out some of the great blog articles, browse through the resource page, and sign up for the newsletters. The newsletters have great content that is exclusive for subscribers. Are you ready for an adventure under the night sky? Let's jump right in. If you've listened to the Night Sky Tourist podcast for a while, you'll know that I love to introduce you to places you can visit to see exceptionally starry night skies. I've taken you to places like Tonto National Monument in Arizona, Hovenweep National Monument in Colorado, Olympic National Park in Washington, Antelope Island in Utah, and other places like that. But I want to emphasize that it's possible to have a night sky related experience in large urban areas too. I'm sure that Los Angeles is one of the last places to pop into your head when we talk about night sky experiences. But if you ever find yourself in that enormous, sprawling city filled with light pollution, there are a couple of places that you should not miss. One is the California Science Center. There is so much to do here, but I want to point out one specific exhibit, the Endeavour Space Shuttle. It's been a long time since I've seen this exhibit, but it left a deep impression in my memory. It started with watching a video of them transporting this spacecraft through the streets of Los Angeles to get it to the California Space Center. It was mind-boggling. Then we entered the pavilion to see the space shuttle in person, and I'm telling you, what an awe-inspiring moment it was to stand under the wing of that thing and to think that it had flown astronauts in space. That was a special moment for me. Another great place you truly don't want to miss is Griffith Observatory. It's one of the most iconic structures in Los Angeles, after the Hollywood sign, of course. And the Hollywood sign is Griffith's next-door neighbor. Los Angeles seems like an unlikely place for an observatory, but once you visit it, you'll understand what a treasure this place is for the people who live there, and why it attracts 1.6 million visitors a year. My guest tonight is Mark Pine, the deputy director of Griffith Observatory, a role that he's had since 2006. He also oversaw the observatory's recent $15 million exhibit expansion program. Prior to Griffith Observatory, he served for 3 years as the outreach manager for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and 10 years at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. He was the recipient of the NASA Exceptional Services Medal Award in 1996. Please join me in welcoming to the podcast, Mark Pine. Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Night Sky Tourist podcast from Los Angeles at Griffith Observatory. And it's a place that I love, so I can't wait to get a little behind the scenes glimpse with you.
Vicki, I'm glad to be here. And the observatory is glad you visited.
So, you know, it's interesting to think about an observatory in Los Angeles, because it seems like a really unlikely place to put a huge observatory, but it's so popular. So tell us a little bit about the history of Griffith Observatory and why it's in Los Angeles.
It's in Los Angeles because that's where Griffith J. Griffith was. And he is the person who gave the money to build the observatory. He's also the person who gave all of the land for Griffith Park that the observatory is part of, which is a 4,000-acre public park that he gave to the city of Los Angeles right before the turn of the century, believing that Los Angeles, which at the time was much smaller than San Francisco in 1896, was going to be a great city, and that a great city like he had observed in Europe needed to have a great park. And so he gave the land to the city took it. Now the park is literally, geographically, figuratively in the middle of 10 million people. So he got that one exactly right. And then he had an experience on Mount Wilson, which is the home of a very prominent research observatory in the LA area. And he looked through a telescope and he had one of those sort of epiphanies that people get every, hopefully once, at least once in their life, and declared that if everyone could look through this telescope, it would change the world. And he believed in the transformative power of observation. And so what he wanted was in his park, or the park that he'd given to the city, he wanted there to be a public observatory. And there was both the inspirational character to it, where he wanted people to have the opportunity to have the experience that he had. But there was also the practical, which is you can't have the public constantly going up and knocking on the door of research observatories saying, we want to look too. So he wanted to give people a place that they could go have his experience, but not bother the researchers. So the reason it's in Los Angeles is because, one, he was from here. Two, everyone that he wanted to have the experience here lived here. Three, there was a wonderful outcropping in the park to be able to build it. And four, he could determine the terms for how that would occur. And in this case, the terms were, I will provide the money to build the observatory, and then I will give it to the city, and the city will run it for free, so that people would all be able to come for free, have that experience. And so it would be a public observatory, no research purpose, totally dedicated to the idea that if people observe the night sky, it will have a transformative effect on them.
And he clearly had no idea that Los Angeles would be a light pollution hub.
So he may not have thought carefully about that, but in fact, he died in 1919 and left the money in his will. And the work on the building actually started in 1933, and architects were hired prior to that. And they determined, and by that time, Los Angeles had gotten quite a bit larger. And there was, as you said, already a fair amount of light pollution from the hundreds of thousands of people who were already here, because Los Angeles at that time was very much centered in the Los Angeles basin, which is where the observatory is sort of sitting right over. So you could already see how things were going to go. The architects brought on experts, and one of the group of experts that they brought on were people who had experience with telescopes. And so they bought a telescope that was designed to be a good instrument for public seeing, despite the light pollution. So you could, even though, you know, and it was a refractor, it's the most looked through telescope in the world. It's from Zeiss. It's a 12-inch refracting telescope, and it's designed to see very bright things very clearly. And it also is designed to provide it. They bought eyepieces that provide very, very easy, if you want to think of it that way, eye relief. Because what we've got are stairs that you walk into the dome, you walk up the stairs, you look through the eyepiece, then you walk down. For each person, it's about 20 seconds. And so what you get is you walk up the stairs, you look through the eyepiece, and the eyepiece needs to help your eye get adapted quickly enough so that you can see the thing you're going to see, enjoy it, and then walk back down the stairs. And so all of that instrumentation was chosen with the idea in mind, yes, it's a public instrument. Yes, people are going to be using it in succession. Yes, we're going to have to deal with light pollution. And as an instrument to do that, it's exactly the right instrument. And it's why, you know, 300, 350 people a night are able to look through it and have that kind of experience that Griffith wanted.
And you've been at Griffith for quite some time. Tell us a little bit how you got involved.
I was working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is about 10 miles away in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. And folks are familiar with JPL as the home of Mars rovers, but they also develop all of the planetary, many of the planetary space exploration craft. They build spacecraft that study the Earth. And I was working there as the outreach manager for the lab. And a delegation from Griffith Observatory Foundation came and were interested in partnering with the lab. And that didn't really lead to anything, but I got to meet them and they got to meet me and they seemed to like me and I liked them. They invited me to join their board of directors. They're the nonprofit that supports the observatory. And then when it came to the time for the renovation, they needed somebody to manage the development of the new exhibit program. So they hired me. I was previously a volunteer. They hired me to the foundation to manage that program on behalf of the observatory. And then when the building was ready to reopen, I was selected to be the deputy director as a City of Los Angeles employee because the city owns and operates the observatory. So in one form or another, either as a volunteer, as a foundation employee, as a city employee, I've been affiliated with the observatory since 1997. And it's a my affiliation and my work here is a perfect example of what happens when you don't completely plan out your entire career and suddenly there's a zig and you can zig with it. And then there's a zag and you can zag with it. And I was able to do that. And as a consequence, I've gotten to be associated with a really, truly wonderful place for the bulk of my professional life.
My visit there with my kids for the first time was so much fun. And, parking was a little bit of a challenge, but, the kids were young and it was a good day, and the park is beautiful. And so, we got to walk through some of the trees and come up there. And, your exhibits are spectacular. I loved them. Some of them were very mesmerizing for me. But when other people come, when guests come for the first time, what can they expect to do and to see when they come and visit Griffith?
You actually described nicely the way that their visit starts, which is they drive up into a park, then they drive up a hill. Parking can be challenging because we're in the middle of a park on the side of a hill, and so there's just limited space for people to park. There are buses that that you can ride, and there's parking below, and you can walk up. And there's parking nearby. But once you're parked, then the building sort of compels you forward toward it, because it's sitting out on a promontory overlooking essentially downtown and the ocean and the rest of the basin of Los Angeles. And it's massive. And if you've never been up here and looked over that, it is for someone like me who's from the Midwest, where everything is very flat. It's a revelation that one, that you can see so far inside a city, and that two, that the city is so big, and that you have that's sort of the first part of the experience that you get is over on the west side, you see the Hollywood sign, then you see the ocean and the rest and part of the city, and then you go around back and you see downtown. And we have some of the most stunning vistas in the city. And then you can go inside the building, and the building's free. So there are no turnstiles or anything like that. You just walk in one of the seven doors, and there are seven different doors. And then you can experience the exhibits, or maybe it's nighttime and you can look through the public telescopes for free. And we've got the one on the roof that I mentioned earlier, but we've also got portables on the lawn so that people can look through those if they don't have time to stand in the line for the one on the roof. You can see our movie that's 24 minutes long about the observatory and how it got created and how it got renovated, narrated by Leonard Nimoy, who is also the namesake of that theater. Or you can go to a show in the Samuel Ocean Planetarium and see one of our shows about the night sky. And it's not a star talk, it's a story about some aspect of the night sky. And the current one that we just opened, our first new show in 10 years, is Signs of Life, and it's about the search for life, but it also, it's not about aliens. It's about, if you wanted to find life and you believe there was life in the universe, how would you look for it? And where would you start? And why would you look for that as opposed to this? And it's sort of a way of getting people to think about how that process would work in a scientific way, but it has these unbelievable visuals. It also has a Zeiss star projector, so you get this beautiful night sky of stars, and you have a live performer who gives the show live every single time. We're one of the last planetariums in the world to do all live programming because we're Hollywood's planetarium, so live programming is exactly what you'd expect.
I do have a question about the pendulum that swings around in that one area. Does that go 24 hours a day?
It does.
I'm so curious about that.
So it's a Foucault pendulum, and we're not the only institution that has one. I think the director is very fond of saying that ours is the most elegant and architecturally integrated of any that he's seen, and he's seen quite a few. The Foucault pendulum is actually a scientific experiment. It's an observation that people get to make on their own by watching it go back and forth. You're basically proving that the Earth is turning. And you prove that by every 5 minutes, the pendulum swings back and forth and it'll knock down a peg. And people will stand there and they'll wait for it and they'll wait for it and they'll wait for it, and then the peg will fall down. And that's proof that everything in the room, the people, the pendulum pit, the pegs, the building, the hill, Los Angeles, the Earth, everything is turning. The only thing that's not turning is the pendulum. So if you imagine the Earth like this and it's turning, the pendulum, if you could look at it from above, the pendulum would always be going like this. And it's never changing its direction. Everything is turning underneath it. That's why it moves enough so that it'll knock down the peg. If you listen to what parents necessarily might be saying to their kids around the pit of the pendulum on a Saturday, it isn't exactly like what I just explained. And so part of our job is to have a guide be there and every 15 or 20 minutes give a talk about what is the pendulum doing and what is it demonstrating, and how is it demonstrating it, and why does that make sense?
And I remember standing there mesmerized by it. Like, I didn't really want to walk away. I wanted to see everything else, but I don't know what it was about it. It is so mesmerizing.
People, you're not alone. There are people who will stand there. I'll stand there and just watch it go back and forth, watch it go back and forth. And maybe it'll knock a peg down during the time you're there, and maybe it won't, but it doesn't really matter. It's just there, you know, it's got travertine and bronze and glass, and it's just the elegance of it, and that it's something, and then you find out what it is. It's doing something, and it is something. And the rest of the building is like that as well. It's what we wanted. It's why we're called an observatory, because we don't just have telescopes, we have instruments. And the pendulum is technically an instrument. And there are instruments throughout the building and on the lawn, like we have a sundial. We have sunset lines on the West Terrace that mark each of the locations of the sunset at the change of seasons. So you can stand on the line, you can look off into the distance, and you can follow the line. And the sun will set on that line on the summer solstice, on the winter solstice, on the fall and spring equinoxes. And people are amazed, how did you know? And the answer is, astronomy is a science. Yeah. It's predictable. And you can embed those things in concrete, and you can be confident that the sun is going to set on them. And the building is filled with those kinds of instruments because we want visitors to become observers themselves, not just to tell them about observation, but to have them observe.
That's so important, I think. You know, I've been thinking even about watches. You know, I wear an Apple Watch a lot, and I love the technology of it, but sometimes I miss like the motion, the mechanics, of just watching it and observing, watching the second hand go around. I don't get to do that on here, but that's such a cool thing to have so many different ways for people to observe with their own eyes. I have in my front yard kind of what you were talking about, little markers that show where the sun rises on each of the solstices and equinoxes. And I'll tell you, it is actually pretty stunning to stand there and to see how different it is between winter sunrise and summer sunrise. You don't realize how dramatic that changes, that shift across the horizon.
And if you show people that, then they start to be able to appreciate whether it's the sunrise or the sunset. It starts to, if you know the sun is setting there and you know it rose over here, it means you can start to understand, oh, so in the winter, the pathway across the sky is very short, which is why the days are short, because the sun is only up from here to here. Whereas if it's in the summer, the sun is rising and it's going much higher because it has to get all the way back over to here. And so it's a way of beginning the conversation about not only what is the sun doing and why is it doing it, but what does it mean? And in that case, it means if it's setting at winter and it's setting really far south, it means its path and time to travel across the sky is relatively short. And so that's why the days are shorter. And then you have exhibits that help. There's a bunch of exhibits. There's six of them actually in the Western Gallery of the historic part of the building that are each focused on a very specific concept: day and night, seasons, tides, moon phases, eclipses, and the sun's path. And each one of them was developed as part of the renovation based on questions that our guides would get from people. Why are there seasons? I don't understand it. Because a lot of people think, oh, well, there's seasons because we're farther away from the sun. Except, well, when it's winter here, it's summer in the southern part. So it doesn't really make sense that we're farther from the sun or closer to the sun. It has to do with the angle of the earth. And you can start to do that, but you need something to help. Because explaining it verbally requires people to do stuff in their heads. Whereas if you have an exhibit and the guides can refer to it and it visually shows the earth rotating around with the axis always pointing in the same direction, you start to get a sense, oh, I see. It's facing the sun more, so it gets more sun. It's facing away from the sun more, so it gets less sun. People can start to appreciate it.
So
You're not a
I had my own experience there in the same way. In those same exhibits you're talking about on the west side of it, I was in my early 30s the first time I visited Griffith, and I remember standing at the one that showed how the phases of the moon worked. And I remember standing there for the longest time while my brain gears were turning as I'm watching this play out, hanging from the ceiling there. Watching that play out, and I all of a sudden was like, oh, I get it. So it's, I learned about the phases of the moon when I was a kid in school, but it just didn't sink into the mechanics of how that was working until I saw that at Griffith
Right.
Observatory.
Those exhibits are designed to illustrate processes that don't reveal themselves to you standing on the surface of the earth. You need the model to be able to grasp, to help you grasp the concept, because otherwise you're standing on the surface and sometimes the day is longer and sometimes it's shorter and the sun appears to move across the sky and yet then the seasons change and the moon phases. And none of those things necessarily, you can figure it out. And you, like you said, you can study it in school. But a model really, a physical model, really does an enormous amount to help people actually. You can stand there and you can watch it and you can see the sunlight and the moon and what you see of it. And all of a sudden, it starts, like you said, to reveal itself to you. And that was the intent.
There is a story that I have come across over and over and over again. And so I would love to hear what you have to say about it. It's a story about a blackout in Los Angeles back in 1994. And the story says that people came out of their houses. I think it was an earthquake that caused the blackout. So, of course, people come out of their houses, out of their apartments at night, and they saw something strange in the sky. And all these people were calling 911. What is this alien thing we're seeing in the sky? And they were told that it was the Milky Way. And so I'm wondering, is that actually a true story or is that urban legend? Because it is a really interesting story.
No, that is not an urban legend. That is a 100% true story. The earthquake happened really, really early in the morning. And so the sun was not up. And so it was still dark, but the city was, as you mentioned earlier, filled with light pollution, you know, and the night sky, it really is stunning how much the night sky disappears when artificial illumination is present. And in the middle of the night is when artificial illumination is the most present. And obviously, the Northridge earthquake, which is a large earthquake, the largest we've had since that time, and it knocked out power to most of the city. And the consequence of that was all of a sudden, all of the artificial illumination went away all at one time. And people, and it was an earthquake. So obviously people ran out of their houses. And now they're outside. There's no artificial illumination. And the night sky, which is always there, is now suddenly visible to them. There are people who'd obviously been out to the desert. They'd seen a night sky. They knew what it was. But there were a lot of people in Los Angeles who had not been out into the desert or had not stayed up to see the sky, you know, when they were, or they were somewhere else, or they were driving, or who even knew. But there were plenty of them who did not know what it was, had not learned about it in school, and suddenly saw this and thought, oh my God, it's the end of the world. Because not just police agencies and 911, but the observatory got a bunch of calls as well, asking what in the world was that, or what in the world is that? And, you know, the answer was, like you said, it's a night full of stars and probably the Milky Way.
Mark, thank you so much for being with us, sharing about Griffith Observatory. And I hope that when people make trips to Los Angeles, they definitely put this at the top of their list because it is worth every minute that they spend there.
We are looking forward to welcoming all of them. And we're almost back to full operation after the pandemic now. So pretty much any day that you would come, we'll pro the only day we're regularly closed is Mondays. So we hope to see everyone up here sometime soon.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
It's time for our tour across the night sky for November 22nd through December 5th, 2022. Pause the podcast, gather everyone in your house, and I'll meet you outside under the stars. Let's start tonight by identifying the three visible planets. Look first toward the east, where you're going to see a bright reddish-colored star. That's Mars, also known as the Red Planet. There's a lot of really cool human-led activity and research happening there right now. And if you're interested, you can follow it on the NASA website at nasa.gov. Now look for another bright planet, much higher and to the west of Mars. It should be easy to find because it's the brightest star in the sky. Well, not a star, but you know what I mean. That's the planet Jupiter. About three fist lengths to the west of Jupiter is the planet Saturn. It's nearly as big as Jupiter, but it's twice as far away from the Earth. It might be difficult for you to pinpoint the correct object, so use a stargazing app if you have one. You can see its rings if you look at it with binoculars or a telescope in your backyard. I've been showing these two planets to people since summer began this year. I always start with Jupiter, and they ooh and ah over seeing its colored stripes and the four Galilean moons. And then I point the telescope at Saturn, and I can predict most people's reaction. About 90% of the time, they gasp and they go, "Oh my God, is that real?" Saturn is the sixth planet from the sun, and it's the second largest just after Jupiter. 760 Earths could fit inside of this ringed planet. As I mentioned already, it's twice the distance from Earth as Jupiter, and it takes light 1 hour and 29 minutes to reflect back to us. In other words, as you're looking at Saturn right now, that's actually where it was almost an hour and a half ago, but it took that long for the light to reach your eyes. It takes Saturn 29 Earth years to complete one orbit around the sun, but its day is a little more than 10 and a half hours long. Because it's spinning so fast, it makes Saturn noticeably bulge at the center. Saturn is less dense than water, so if you had a swimming pool large enough to hold it, it would float. And the reason is that the planet is made almost entirely of gas, so it has no solid surface, just like its neighbor Jupiter. Astronomers believe that 2 tons of Saturn's mass came from the Earth, so that creates some really interesting questions that I don't have answers for. Galileo was the first person to look at the planet with a telescope, and he thought it had handles or arms sticking out from it. But then 45 years later, after telescopes got a little better, another astronomer announced that Saturn actually had rings orbiting it. The beautiful rings are part of what makes us love it so much. They're mostly made out of ice and rock, and some of those are as small as a grain of sugar, and some are as big as a house. A 2016 study showed that the debris that makes up the rings could be the remains of dwarf planets that broke apart in an extremely distant past. Saturn's massive size, location in the solar system, and its gravitational pull lets it steer many dangerous asteroids away from the Earth, so it does a really important job of protecting us. Saturn has 82 known moons. Can you imagine what that would look like looking up into that sky? Titan is the largest, and it's even bigger than Mercury. It's the second largest moon in the entire solar system. Jupiter's Ganymede is the largest, but our moon is only the fifth largest. Some of Saturn's moons may be able to support life because they contain water. One of them even has about 100 spouting geysers. Saturn is named after the Roman god of wealth and agriculture. In the ancient Greek culture, Saturn represented the god Cronos, the god of time. In Hindu astrology, Saturn is called Shani, and he judges everyone based on the good and the bad deeds that they did during their life. In the ancient Chinese and Japanese cultures, it's known as Earth Star, which is based on the five elements. Our favorite day of the week was named in honor of Saturn, Saturday. But it was the Romans who had the most extensive myths about the planet. They believed the god Saturn was the father of Jupiter, Neptune, Pluto, and others. And every year in December, the Romans celebrated the festival of Saturnalia at the time of the winter solstice. It was a time of feasting, role reversals, free speech, gift giving, and revelry. And some of these traditions even found their way into our modern Christmas holiday. Now let's do a quick little bit of constellation jumping. Look back toward the eastern horizon where you're going to see Orion laying on his side. The easiest way to spot him is to look for the 3 stars equally spaced in a straight row. That's his belt. In January, I'm going to share some really fun cultural star stories about Orion once he reaches a higher position in the sky. To the west of Orion is the constellation Taurus. The ancient Greeks and Romans saw him as a giant bull with his super long horn stretched above his head. There are 2 things you can look for to identify Taurus. One is the bright reddish colored star called Aldebaran. Now, to distinguish it from Mars, Mars is much bigger and brighter, but Aldebaran is smaller and it twinkles. Planets don't twinkle. Another way to identify Taurus is by finding the V-shaped pattern of stars connected to Aldebaran. That star grouping, called an asterism, is known as the Hyades. To the west of the Hyades is another asterism within Taurus called the Pleiades. It's a tiny cluster of really bright stars that kind of looks a little bit like the Little Dipper. In fact, many people think it's the Little Dipper, although the Little Dipper is in a completely different part of the sky to the north. The Pleiades is one of my favorite things in the winter night sky, so next month I'm going to share some great cultural star stories about it. The rest of the constellations along the ecliptic are made of dim stars, so if you're in a light polluted area, they're a bit more difficult to see. You can use your stargazing app to find Aries, Pisces, and Aquarius to take you all the way across to the western horizon. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to all the things mentioned in this episode, or visit nightskytourist.com/53. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Night Sky Tourist Podcast. If you enjoy the Night Sky Tourist Podcast, please show your support by subscribing to it in your podcatcher and leave a written review. Your reviews are really important to me, and they help others discover the podcast. Be sure to visit nightskytourist.com for great articles and resources. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter for exclusive content. We'll see you here again in 2 weeks. Until then, keep looking up.